So, hello everyone. Welcome to our latest episode of Kidney Compass, your guide to navigating the latest developments in kidney disease clinical trials. In this podcast, we explore the latest in trials from therapeutic to methodological advances. And today I'm joined by my co-host, Shikha Udwani, and a special guest from ERA Congress in Vienna. And I'm really devastated to not be there in person. I'm sitting in Sydney. But Shikha and Vlado Perkovic are in Vienna. Hi, guys.
Hi, Brendan.
Hi, Brendan. Wish you were here.
We do wish you were here. And, you know, we're very, very lucky to have Vlado with us and making time to talk about some really exciting news.
Yeah, so I was just following online on X all the late-breaking presentations, and our listeners might have seen Vlado present the results of the Visionary trial. And so we're here to talk about that today and hear about those results from the interim analysis.
So I think we can go ahead and start with, you know, Vlado, the landscape for IgA nephropathy is rapidly changing. I have joked about this before, but I haven't been able to give the same talk on IgA nephropathy twice in the last few years because we keep having new data, which is so exciting for our field and for our patients. I think that the Visionary trial has been long awaited. You know, the press release was announced many months ago. We've been waiting to hear the actual numbers. But I also think this is a very unique study because of the mechanism of action of this drug. So could you share with our listeners a little bit about sibeprolimab and the design of Visionary as you did earlier today? And then, you know, kind of tell us how this data really changes our landscape for IgAN.
Thanks. You're very happy to do that and delighted to be here with you. So thanks for asking me. You know, we're in the middle of a golden age in IgA nephropathy and truly in nephrology more broadly. We're generating high quality data regarding potentially important treatments, and many of them are making dramatic differences to key things that matter to our patients. And that's certainly true in IgA nephropathy at the moment. We've also learned a lot about the underlying pathophysiology of conditions like IgA nephropathy, and we've learned more detail about the immunological basis, the fact that it's a B-cell driven disease. We have galactose deficient IgA1 produced by B-cells. That's then formed into circulating immune complexes with autoantibodies, IgG autoantibodies to that galactose deficient IgA1, and those circulating immune complexes depositing the kidney and initiate the inflammation and subsequent changes that occur. We've had treatments available for a long time. We've used RAS blockers for decades in people with IgA nephropathy, but of course, RAS blockade likely acts by reducing some of the hemodynamic mechanisms that potentiate established kidney damage that don't actually address the underlying pathological process. And we've now got additional therapies that likely do the same thing. SGLT2 inhibitors, again, likely act through hemodynamic mechanisms that are independent of the initiating cause of kidney damage. And that's important. We want those and we should use them, but they don't address the fundamental cause of the disease. More recently, endothelin antagonists can also be added to that list. And whilst we still need to learn a lot more about how they work, those hemodynamic disease-independent mechanisms are likely to still be important. In terms of treatments that address the underlying biology of this condition, we've used corticosteroids and other immunosuppressive therapies also for a very long time and shown that they actually do work in reducing proteinuria and preventing kidney failure in people with IgA nephropathy. But we also know that that comes at a dramatic cost in terms of high-dose corticosteroids, with serious infections and deaths occurring in some patients. So we really need much more specific and targeted treatments that allow us to address the fundamental causes. Perhaps the first of those that became available was iptacopan. More recently, which is a factor B inhibitor, acts through the alternative complement pathway and addresses some of the immunological processes that occur in IgA nephropathy. But that treatment, based on our current understanding, still likely only addresses the sort of glomerular inflammation that occurs as a result of the immune complex deposition. So it's still well down the pathway of activity. So the really exciting thing about sibeprenlimab, about APRIL inhibitors, about the B-cell therapies that are being developed is they address the fundamental underlying abnormality. They address the problem, the disease at its root, and reduce the formation of galactose-deficient IgA1. We've seen reductions of two-thirds with sibeprenlimab of galactose-deficient IgA1 in the phase 2 trial. We see reductions in IgA more broadly, lesser reductions in IgG, about a third, and reductions in IgM. So we're actually addressing the fundamental process that's driving at the very upstream end, driving the abnormalities in IgA nephropathy. So that's the really exciting thing about sibeprenlimab and the other agents in this class. So Visionary is the first phase 3 trial to report its interim proteinuria data. It's a large trial in IgA nephropathy, 530 patients randomized altogether. So the biggest ever trial in IgA nephropathy conducted to date. 20 of those participants are people in an exploratory cohort with low EGFR, 20 to 30 mils per minute, but the other 510 are the main study cohort. And the analysis that we presented today was the first 320 patients that were randomized with their 40-week proteinuria data. And this was the pre-specified primary analysis of the trial. And what we found was that at 40 weeks, proteinuria was reduced by 51.2% with sibeprenlimab compared to placebo. And that's a startling treatment effect. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be honest, if someone had told me that a treatment was going to reduce proteinuria by 50%, I wouldn't have believed it based on what we've known. But we see that, and that's a numerically larger number than we've seen with some of the other treatments, with complement inhibitors, endothelin antagonists, SGLT2 inhibitors. And again, fits with that underlying, model that we're really getting to the root cause of the condition. So it's really promising from that point of view. What we're also concerned about was the safety profile. We've seen real safety concerns and safety issues with corticosteroids. So I, for one, was concerned that we might see an increase in infection risk in particular with this class of agents. But the data on those first 320 patients looks remarkably clean. No increase in adverse events, no increase in serious adverse events or severe adverse events, no increase in infection-related adverse events. The only difference that we saw was a slight imbalance in COVID, a little bit more COVID in the sibeprenlimab arm than the placebo arm. But in the phase 2 ENVISION trial, that pattern was actually reversed. So my guess is that that was probably a chance finding, but we'll learn more as more data becomes available from these agents. So other than that, the safety data looks remarkably clean. There's no suggestion of any increase in the risk of opportunistic infections. None were observed. It really does suggest that we might be getting to a much more precise approach to the fundamental pathological abnormality in IgA nephropathy. Now, this is the proteinuria data. It's incredibly promising. The phase 2 GFR data looks, if anything, even more promising. But we need to wait now for the remaining EGFR and other outcome data at 2 years of follow-up, which will be available next year. And it's looking really promising from the point of view of what these class of drugs might be able to do for people with IgA nephropathy.
I mean, I think for people that were here, there was applause in the room here in Vienna when Vlado showed the results. And I think, to your point, this is the largest IgAN trial conducted to date. This is the largest reduction in proteinuria that we've seen at an interim analysis. One of the things that stuck out to me, which I thought you really beautifully showed, was unlike some of the prior trials, you actually do have data on proteinuria reduction at various intervals, including, I believe, starting at 4 weeks. And you're already starting to see a significant decline in proteinuria, whereas there are other therapies where we maybe didn't see that for several months. Exactly to your point, when we're really targeting, the source of the production of the galactose-deficient IgA1. Does it surprise you that, this is a heterogeneous group of patients? These are, I think someone brought up, these are not incident IgAN patients. Were you surprised to see this large of an effect, given the fact that some of these patients have had this disease for a very long time? And as we know, because of the nature of this disease, patients don't necessarily even present when the disease initiates. So there's already a lag by the time they get their biopsy. Their disease could have been going on for months to years. And then from the time of diagnosis to enrolling in a trial, was that something that surprised you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, we saw, as you say, effects within the first 8 weeks. It was very clear that the sibeprenlimab arm already had lower proteinuria on a spot urine protein creatinine ratio, and that the magnitude of that effect increased out to 12 months. And it'll be really interesting to see in the subsequent data whether that continues to increase, because we just don't know at this stage. But it looks really promising. As you say, the median time from biopsy was roughly 18 months in this trial, in this 320 patient cohort. So they'd already had diagnosed disease for a couple of years on average, and may well have had, almost certainly had the disease for many years prior to that. So to be able to effectively have such a profound impact on turning off the disease, almost, that's probably an over-exaggeration. I shouldn't use that phrase. It's not really turning it off, but it's certainly really dramatically dialing down the impact, certainly as measured by proteinuria, of this condition is a surprise. And, you know, as I said earlier, I didn't think we'd see treatments that could individually lower proteinuria by 50% in this condition, but here we are. And it was a very precise effect. Confidence intervals range from 43 to 58%. So it was pretty tight. You know, this is a really big effect, and it augurs well for the effects on kidney function moving forward.
Yeah. And the other thing that, you know, for listeners, this was, I believe, the first trial to have a substantial number of patients in an IgAN trial on background, not just RAS inhibition, but also SGLT2 inhibitors. So I know the 320 patients you presented today, you know, fewer of them were on RAS inhibition than the entire 500-ish patient cohort. But I believe upwards of 50% of patients were on background SGLT2 inhibitor, still had enough proteinuria to go into the study, and then you're still seeing a dramatic effect. So I'd love to kind of hear what your thoughts are on that. And then when, if you don't know, do you know when you'll be able to share with us, you know, the subgroup analyses of those on SGLT2 inhibitors and those not on SGLT2 inhibitors? Do you think that it's possible that the ones who are not may have an even more dramatic reduction in proteinuria?
Yeah. So about half of the patients are on SGLT2 inhibitors, as you say, and that's really nice from a trialist perspective, because it gives us nice power to be able to compare those who were and were not. And that data, a little scoop for you, will be presented likely later this year. So we'll see that data specifically. And I can't speak about what we've seen today, but we will look at that in detail. And you could argue both ways. These are entirely independent mechanisms of effect. One's more likely to be more hemodynamic, the other's really addressing the underlying immunology. So it could be that they're additive, or it could be that there's some attenuation of the benefit in people who are already receiving benefit from an SGLT2 inhibitor. So the data will be really important, and I look forward to sharing it when I can. One thing that we can say is that there is a clue from iptacopan. So iptacopan, in its APPLAUSE trial we reported last year, and we had about 15% of the population on SGLT2 inhibitors, but in the subgroup analysis from that data, the treatment effect was exactly the same with iptacopan in people who were and weren't on SGLT2 inhibitors, and was separately statistically significantly reduced in the SGLT2 inhibitor subgroup. So pretty clear data. And that maybe suggests that these benefits may be additive, and, you know, that we might have multiple tools that we can put together to achieve optimal outcomes for our patients moving forward.
Absolutely. Brendan?
Yeah, Vlada, you bring up an interesting point about the background use of SGLT2 inhibitors. When did you start Visionary, and were you surprised by the high prevalent use of SGLT2 inhibitors at about 40 or 50%?
Yeah, we started it must be 3 or 4 years ago now. So it's, I'd have to go back and check the dates, but it's been going for quite a while. And clearly over that period of time, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of people with IgAN nephropathy being treated with SGLT2 inhibitors appropriately. And I think when the first DAPA-CKD analysis came out showing benefit, even in IgAN nephropathy of people with SGLT2 inhibitors, there were lots of people who looked for reasons why that wasn't robust or reliable, and tried to, you know, they were uncertain about the value. And I think as we've explored that further, and as EMPA-KIDNEY subsequently confirmed that finding, it's pretty clear that these drugs also have benefits in IgAN nephropathy. So that uptick in use is exactly what I'd hope for, and I'm pleased to see. But, it, you know, again, it raises the question of what the optimal treatment strategy is going to be moving forward. And I think this is one of those fork in the road moments for us. You know, do we start with a treatment, a B-cell therapy, because it's, you know, it's addressing the fundamental cause of the disease? We can hopefully make a profound impact on subsequent trajectory of the condition, and then use treatments like SGLT2 inhibitors, maybe interferon antagonists, complement inhibitors in those people who have an incomplete response or who remain at high risk. That's one approach. Or do we do the reverse and start with those simple background therapies and reserve these immunological drugs for those people who don't respond adequately to the, if you like, the simpler measures? And I think you can make arguments for and against both of them. I think the intellectual appeal of addressing the B cells that drive the disease is strong here. But that's going to depend on safety. It's going to depend on cost. It's going to depend on access. So all of these factors are going to play up. But I'd love to see some head-to-head trials as well of the different strategies, a B-cell strategy versus perhaps a more non-specific strategy, and look at what happens to patients over time. I think that would be really interesting.
Yeah. It's so hard still to predict. You know, we have the MES-C score, we have proteinuria, hematuria, we have the International IgAN Prediction Tool. I think we're still struggling a little bit upfront to know which patients are going to progress. We obviously recognize that we need to strive towards lower proteinuria thresholds. But I think it's really hard because some patients are going to do well and stay at very low grade proteinuria. However, a lot of registry data is showing us that that's not necessarily the case. It's not as benign of a condition as we previously thought. And I think using some of the older data is challenging because we didn't have therapies that act, sort of upfront aspects of the disease. So
we didn't have any specific therapies, actually, you know, and certainly in my own clinical practice in the past, if someone had a gram of proteinuria and some hematuria and stable kidney function, you know, the idea of exposing them to a biopsy and the risk associated with that wasn't necessarily attractive, you know, and in many cases, I might have chosen to watch some of those patients because I'm going to give them RAS blockade anyway. If their kidney function's stable, I'd reassure myself that actually, they'll do okay. But what we haven't perhaps done properly is considered the lifetime risk of kidney failure in those people.
Right.
And whilst their kidney function might be stable over a year or two, over a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades, remembering these are young patients, they're likely to lose substantial amounts of kidney function, and a large proportion of them will end up on dialysis. So I think the other exciting thing about these treatments becoming available is it should re-energize us all to go looking much harder for IgA nephropathy and getting treatment to our patients much earlier than perhaps we had in the past.
Yeah. One of the other questions I had with the data you showed today, compared to many of our other phase 3 trials and even the phase 2, the placebo group actually had an increase in proteinuria rather than a decrease, which of course then affects the delta. Granted, you know, the absolute change in UPCR with sibeprylimab is still over 50%. But do you have any thoughts on why the placebo group had an increase in proteinuria rather than a decrease as you would expect and, you know, from other trials?
Yeah, I mean, we would often expect to see a slight decrease because we're selecting patients for the presence of proteinuria, and therefore some of those will be, you know, incidentally overestimates, and therefore we'll see some regression to the mean. So we often do see a small reduction in the level of proteinuria in placebo arm, but there's a lot of variability around that. Mm-hmm. And I suspect what we're seeing here is just random chance. I wouldn't read anything much into it. And I think one of the things we do have to be a bit careful of, and I'll warn people against, is trying to do comparisons between trials. Mm-hmm. Because of the fact that there are so many differences between them, not just in the treatment, but also the populations, the measurements that are done, the way that they're measured, the time that they're measured, the way that they're analyzed. There are so many variables that looking at inter-trial comparisons is fraught. And I would urge extreme caution in doing that.
What are your thoughts about the baseline GFR in this trial compared to others? Just from a glance, it seemed that there was a bit more preserved GFR in these patients compared to some of our other phase 3 trials. And do you think that may impact the results at all?
Yeah, so in this trial, the mean eGFR at baseline was 63. We didn't have an upper limit of eGFR for entry, so we took all comers above 30 in terms of eGFR. So that doesn't surprise me and encourages me, to be honest, because addressing the disease before these people have lost a substantial amount of kidney functions, I think really exciting. And again, intellectually would feel like the right approach. Mm-hmm. But we'll need to wait for the subgroup data to have a look at whether there are differences according to different levels of eGFR. I'd be surprised if there was. I don't think we've seen consistency in any sort of variation by baseline level in eGFR with the treatments that we've got to date. So I would hope that we'll see consistency, but let's wait for the data.
Yeah. A lot more waiting to do.
Not for too.
So Vlada, you bring up the issue of or the prospect of head-to-head trials with so many new treatments for IgA nephropathy. What do you think the next generation of randomized trials in IgA nephropathy might look like? Should we be thinking more about active controlled designs, factorial designs, combination therapy trials? Are placebo-controlled trials still valuable and appropriate in this space? Interested to hear your thoughts on this evolving space.
So my answer to most of those questions, all of them probably, is yes. But in more detail, look, you know, the landscape's evolving. I think, you know, it's important to acknowledge the role that the FDA broadly, but Aliza Thompson in particular, has played in changing the world when it comes to the outlook for people with IgA nephropathy. The work that she and a lot of people at the Kidney Health Initiative did to develop this pathway for accelerated approval and then full approval has provided the sort of certainty that's allowed companies and biotechs to invest in the area. And we've seen this explosion of trials in IgA nephropathy that's a direct result of the work that Aliza and her team have done. So I think she deserves a knighthood or something.
Yes,
what she's done.
Not the board.
Yeah. But the world's changing, and we now have a number of approved agents, including a couple that are fully approved already, and we're likely to see more of those, obviously, over coming years. And the question is, should we evolve our approach? And we're learning more. The 9-month proteinuria approach was for accelerated approval was a relatively conservative one, still requiring 2-year eGFR data. The question will be, is 2 years still required at some point? Or is it possible to base full approval on earlier time points, for example, given that not all patients are recruited at the same time? So even in a trial with, you know, a 9-month proteinuria outcome, we'll have some people who've been followed up for 18 months or even 2 years. And so we could look at the totality of that data and look at the effects on eGFR slope. I think that's a question that is worth exploring and asking whether, based on that sort of analysis and the data we've got from the trials that have been completed to date, whether we might be able to take another step forward in approving drugs even a little earlier. And I think that's an open question that is really exciting for us and worth exploring. The question of what the background treatment should be is a really interesting one. I think some head-to-head trials of individual agents or even just different strategies would be really exciting and important, and I hope those get done. I'm feeling pretty optimistic with the number of agents that are in the area that we will see some trials like that, but remains to be seen. The traditional approach we've used for trials where there's, you know, new treatments becoming available is to allow background treatment. And that's important as well, because many of these drugs are very expensive. And even if they are available for purchase, they may not be affordable or accessible for large proportions of the population. So requiring those treatments would mean that we're only restricting opportunities to an ever smaller proportion of the population. I'd much rather see us develop things that are available to the total population of people with IgA nephropathy. And the other advantage is, of course, that as we get more drugs approved, there's likely to be price pressure that will drive those prices down and help make them more accessible. So I think all of those approaches are going to be important, using different strategies. In some cases, perhaps mandating background therapy. We've done that with RAS blockade. I'm not sure that that's been terribly helpful, to be honest, in the trials that we've done, either in IgA nephropathy or in CKD or diabetic kidney disease. But it's been something that has become entrenched and established. So that's fine. But I don't think, I wouldn't like to see us take that approach with other treatments. I think we need to recognize that there's differences in preferences, in suitability, that mean individuals might choose different treatments. And we should acknowledge that and allow them to do that and then test our new therapies on top of those best available therapies. So I think that as a general approach would be the one I would favor. But I'd also like to see some head-to-head trials of different classes of agents.
You know, excited to hear you talk about, you know, potentially looking at different approval pathways based on, you know, maybe earlier data. One of the things that I was looking back at ENVISION and the UPCR decline and how that translated to a 12-month GFR slope, which was, to be honest, quite flat in the 4 milligram and the 8 milligram. And obviously, I know that that data is not ready to be shared yet. But I do wonder if we've seen similar results in a phase two as we're seeing in a large phase three, could that sort of lead us to believe that, you know, we don't need to wait for 2-year GFR data? Your thoughts?
Yeah, remember, most of these trials were designed with the hope that we'd see differences between arms of 1 or 2 mils per minute per year. And if we look at the phase two ENVISION trial for sibeprenlimab, we're seeing differences of 5 or 6 millimeters mils per minute per year. So much, much bigger treatment effects, which mean that we're likely to be grossly overpowered if those are the real effects. And we're likely, perhaps even at the interim analysis, to have much more certainty than we expected to have about the likely benefits. I mean, it's still important, I think, to look at some longer-term data, and that will be a question. How much longer-term data will we need? But I think, you know, with drugs that appear this potent, having perhaps even a more accelerated, full approval pathway is something that will be interesting to explore.
Yeah, absolutely. It would be great to get the drugs to our patients sooner. One of the things that I think I found interesting in the phase two, and I know you don't have this data to share yet, was after you discontinued Sibi, you do have quite a rapid increase in UPCR as well as Gd-IgA1. When you think about the mechanism of the disease, and this, you know, is not necessarily unique to this particular B cell modulator, does that surprise you that there's not more of a legacy effect? Obviously, you know, people will say, okay, well, you just have to stay on the drug. And unfortunately, our patients don't necessarily want to indefinitely be on therapies if they can avoid it. But, you know, we'll obviously wait to see those results for the phase three. But what are your thoughts on the rapidity of the, you know?
It's an interesting question. And there's certainly data from a couple of the agents in this class suggesting rapid rebound of lactose deficient IgA1 levels, and with that, proteinuria, suggesting that, you know, you're literally turning a switch on and off. And that, you know, that has pros and cons. On the one hand, it does mean ongoing therapy is likely to be required with some of these agents. There are new agents being developed where it's thought that they may not have such a rapid return of IgA1 levels, and that they might actually have a longer lasting effect. But we also need to think about the downsides of that. You know, if, for example, there is an infection risk. We haven't seen that to date in the data that's publicly available, to my knowledge. Then, you know, the idea of being able to turn that off would suddenly become attractive in people who might have an infection. But I think we have to look at what the full data show us. And I think we can also learn some lessons from some of the other treatments. So I had the privilege of leading the testing trial of methylprednisolone and IgA nephropathy. And there we treated with people with up to 9 months of steroids. And when we looked at the data, we saw that reduced proteinuria for about 2 years. But then proteinuria rebounded back and was back to, you know, the same level as the placebo group after about 2 to 3 years. And the slope of eGFR decline after that was much the same as well. So even treatments which perhaps produce longer lasting effects, you know, might not produce effects forever. I don't think we've currently got treatments that can entirely turn off the disease. And the question is really more one of how long do they turn it off for before we need to redose. For the APRIL inhibitors, the data we've got to date suggests continuing therapy may well be required.
Sorry, Brendan, I have so many questions to ask. So chime in here at any time. What are your thoughts about monitoring? So we know that, you know, this class of drugs reduces Gd-IgA1. We see, you know, dramatic decreases in APRIL levels. None of these are commercially available yet. I know there's some hematuria data that's going to be, I think, published soon with ENVISION. Obviously, proteinuria, we know that data, although we see proteinuria reduction with a lot of other classes of drugs, where do you think we're going to be moving towards in terms of, and, you know, the other thing is, looking at immunoglobulin levels from a safety perspective, is that something that we should be monitoring as we think about these drugs coming to market and empowering our nephrology community to use them? I think we also need to provide some guidance on how to, you know, appropriately monitor these patients, because this is somewhat new, you know, for us.
you ask hard questions, but they're very good ones. And I don't know that I can answer them because I don't think we've got the data necessarily to answer them, but they're the right things that we need to be asking. You know, if someone starts with 2 grams of proteinuria and IgA nephropathy and they have a 50% reduction with sibeprenlimab down to 1 gram, is their risk the same as someone else with IgA nephropathy and 1 gram of proteinuria? And we know in conditions like diabetic kidney disease, we've got very good data that Hitto Lambers here speak and others have generated showing that that is actually true, that the level of proteinuria predicts outcome pretty consistently regardless of what other therapies someone's on. Whether that'll be true with treatments like, APRIL inhibitors remains to be seen. I would guess it probably will, but that data will be important and it will need to be generated. So I'm not sure how useful proteinuria is going to be, how much of a driver of risk it's going to be. I think it will be important, but that remains to be seen. Other markers like galactose-deficient IgA, 1 levels, I don't think we know enough about them yet to know whether they're also useful as guides to treatment. Should we aim for a target GDA or IgA 1 level, or do we just monitor it? And how should we monitor for risk of infection? The data at the moment looks so clean that one could argue that there's no point monitoring routinely. But I think we need more data to know that with certainty. So I don't know the answer to any of those questions, but they're good ones.
Okay. Well, Sheik and Vlado, so great to join you in Vienna. You've made my FOMO worse. I wish I could be there with you. It's been a tremendous pleasure, as always, chatting to you, Vlado. And so that wraps up our episode of Kidney Compass from ERA in Vienna. Hope you've enjoyed our coverage. We've got a couple of more episodes incoming on HCP Live. As always, if you have any suggestions for topics you'd like me and Sheik to cover, please reach out to us and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any episodes. Thanks for tuning in.